Rabosa, we're looking at the Mishnah on Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, and this is what I call the procedural Mishnah. The Mishnah is going to address the procedure for Mei Merarin, for this woman who's a Sota, she's after Kini and Stira, as you know, and now we have to have her drink from the Mei Merarin. And the underlying principle of this Mishnah is we have to do everything that we can to try to impact or try to influence her to drop out. Now, what does that mean to drop out? And why do we want to influence her to drop out? You know, we're at this advanced stage. You know, we've already established with testimony that there was Kinui, there was Stira. Now let's get down to business. You know, let's already go through this procedure. Why are we hesitating? Why are we trying to fight it? And what can we gain? How can we have a method to try to stop the whole procedure and freeze it midway so that we can change our minds and throw in our towel and say, forget it? So that both questions really are related to each other. The answer to the first question is, how can we possibly freeze this whole process midway before we get to the culmination? Is by getting her to admit. She cannot say, well, I deny it, because if she denies that she had this adulterous relationship, then she has to drink from the Mei Merarin. But she could say, paradoxically, that I was guilty. And if she says I was guilty, then what happens is we don't have evidence to prove that she's guilty. You know, she had this relationship in private. There were no eidim, no witnesses. But what we do, even though we don't believe her, which means we're not going to put her to death, but we end the relationship, we force the husband to give her a get, she's divorced, but she will not drink from the Mei Merarin. The Torah says that she only drinks from the bitter waters if she insists on her innocence. We think that she's guilty. There's a lot of evidence here, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, that she was guilty as accused. I mean, she had kinui, she had stira. None of this was kosher v'yosha. She shouldn't have been doing such a thing. Imagine that she went into a private place with this man, and her husband already warned her, you know, that he suspects something's going on here. But she nevertheless violated that. So she's not, you know, she's not the most kosher woman in the world, so to speak. But on the other hand, we don't know, so we're not sure. So we have Mei Merarin. We have this whole process. Now, what would freeze the process and terminate it prematurely so that we don't have to get it to drink from the Mei Merarin is if she would admit her guilt. So the Mishnah is going to tell us, how do we cajole her? How do we influence her? How do we scare the living daylights out of her to adduce from her, to invoke a confession from her? That's the subject of the Mishnah. Now ask the second question. Why are we so eager to terminate this process prematurely? And what's the answer?
The answer is so you don't have to erase the name of Hashem.
Exactly. So you learned this Mishnah already. I don't know, Rabbi Mines told me.
No?
Okay, so you're very advanced. So you don't need the Shia. You could go now. But you can back out now. But if you want to stay, you're certainly invited. And you're right, because the process of drinking Mei Merarin is a process which entails taking the name of God, writing it on a cloth, on a parchment, and erasing it. We're going to have to actually obliterate it, and that's a violation of a terrible affair. We don't appreciate this. We don't come from that cultural society where we can have that profound sensitivity to this tragedy, this catastrophe of taking the name of God and obliterating it. It's just so foreign to us. Chazal was so sensitive to this. I'll give you an example. The name of God is so holy that in this week's parasha, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he meets God at the Sneh, the first question he's going to ask is, Mashmi, the people of Israel want to know what your holy name is. We don't have this sensitivity to the sanctity of the holy name of God. You know, okay, write the name of God and you obliterate it, big deal. But it's a terrible, terrible avera. The Torah allows to do it in order to hope that we can prove her innocence. And that's called shalom bayis, to reinstitute this marriage, get it back on its feet, on the assumption that she's guiltless. But on the other hand, if there's any way of avoiding this, we would rather try to avoid the whole process so that we don't have to obliterate the name of God. So how do we scare her and hope that maybe she'll admit and confess her crime, and then, as I said before, she'll get a divorce from her husband, and that's where we go from here, and we don't have to go through this whole process. So in terms of the procedure, number one, Hayumalim Osa LeBezdin HaGadol BiYerushalayim. Now, this statement is based on a Mishnah at the beginning of Masechta Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin is divided up into three different categories of judges. There's one Bezdin, which is made up of three judges, and then we go to a higher Bezdin, which is called Sanhedrin Aktana, and that's made of 23 judges, until finally we get to the highest level, which is the Bezdin that represents Klal Yisrael, the ultimate high Supreme Court, and that's made up of 71 elders. And all this is derived from Moshe Rabbeinu, because Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Mishpatim that he should appoint judges, and those judges will make up the highest court of Israel. And the law of Sota is that a Sota has to be brought in front of the highest court of Israel. Now, it could be that in a lower court we can receive and accept the witnesses who testify by Kiri and Stira, but the procedure by which we give her the Meimorim to drink, that has to take place and cannot take place in any other Bezdin lower courts other than the High Court of Israel, and that's called Bezdin HaGadol. Now notice that the Mishnah says Hayu Malim Osa. Mala means that they, and we'll have to see who the they are, bring her up to the High Court of Israel. And that's called a Levui. Levui means that we want her to be sort of protected almost. To be, you know, there's going to be an entourage that's going to escort her. The reason for that, the Gemara is going to talk about, is to make sure that her husband doesn't come too close to her, because the law is that he also has to be clean of any violation. He's not allowed to have any intimacy with her. But now we get to the main subject of this Mishnah, Ma'ayimim Aleha. We put the fear of the Lord in her heart. Now this word, Ma'ayimim Aleha, this phrase is borrowed from a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. This Mishnah in Sota is a mirror image of a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, on Daf Chav Zayin. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin says that when two witnesses come in front of a Bezdin to testify in a capital crime, then Ma'aymim Aleihem. Ma'aymim Aleihem means we warn them that they are now getting involved in a very serious matter. They're about to testify in a case of life or death. And if they perjure themselves, then they are guilty of the most hideous violations. And here too, with Ma'aymim Aleha, we're going to warn her. And what are we going to say to her? Kiderech Shema'aymim Al Eidim Fash, just like we warn the Eidim who are testifying in a capital case, to make sure that they understand the repercussions if they're guilty of perjuring themselves. By the way, it's very interesting, the Mishnah describes the Iyum of Eidei Nefashos, and the whole thrust of it is don't lower yourself. Have what we call Kavod HaAdam. Have self-respect. And they go on to tell the person, these two witnesses, what it means to have self-respect, to realize how great you are. Would you lower yourself and commit this heinous crime of perjuring yourself in a under oath, you know, so to speak, in a court of law for a witness, of a testimony. So how do we inspire them or influence them to appreciate the greatness of man? We tell them an answer to the following question: why did God create one man? Only one single man. And the answer is to prove and to convey, to transmit this message that if a person saves one life, it's as if he saved the entire world. If a person destroys one life, it's as if he had destroyed the entire world. So know, if you have any self-respect, that what you're about to do, if you're testifying falsely, is you're about to destroy the entire world. But what can we say to this woman who's a Sota, to try to cajole her, to try to influence her, that she should drop out, that she should admit her guilt? What warnings can we give her? And it's very interesting. What the Mishnah is going to do is the Mishnah is going to apply different psychological tricks, so to speak, to get her into the mood to confess her crime. The first psychological trick is to tell her that if you are guilty as accused of this crime, there are certain explanations and reasons that brought you to do this crime, to commit this avera. There are certain influences in your life that may have actually set the background and the influence for you to fall prey to the most hideous crime of immorality, of adultery. So we say to Biti, now the opening line, Biti, my daughter, is a way of conveying the message that we mean this for your benefit. Not only are we trying to protect the name of God, the holy name of God, but we're also interested in your benefit, because at the end of the day, you're going to die. So Biti is a way of saying, we're really on your side here. We're really working for your benefit. And if we can induce a confession from you, you're better off. So now we're going to talk to her in very inspiring words and explain to her why she may have done what she did. And the Mishnah is going to give no less than four different explanations as to what influences she came under, that and she fell prey to the Eitzahara, to the evil inclination, and she committed this Avera. The first is what we call Yayin. And the Gemara tells us in Masechet Nazir that the reason a Nazir takes upon himself Nazirus is because he saw a Sota. And if he saw a Sota and he saw what they did to a Sota, and she was guilty of this crime of adultery, and as a result her body is sort of like blown up almost. So immediately he says, you know what, this is the influence of wine. I have to take wine out of my daily diet. And a Nazir, as you know, is not allowed to drink wine. Now, again, drinking wine is not something that the Torah is opposed to. In fact, the Torah saw wine as a challenge for spirituality. We make Kiddush ala Geffen. We have a special bracha to thank Hashem for wine. We even have another bracha which is called Atovu Meitiv if we get an upgrade of our wine. Wine is a great thing. And the Torah is very careful. We want kosher wine. We don't drink non-kosher wine. Drinking wine is an entire process. There's one day of the year we're obligated to drink wine to excess. Which is that day?
Purim.
So wine is not a negative thing per se.
Pesach
also, you're right, but in the case of Purim, it's almost the essence of what Purim is all about. But yet, there's a negative side. And this dates back to the time of Noach. Noach already gets drunk after he comes out of the Teva, and what happens as a result? But the influence of wine is well known. And therefore, don't be, we won't be shocked, so to speak, if you confess your crime, because it's a result of wine. A woman would not naturally want to have this relationship, but if she was under the influence of intoxicated wine, that's what may have caused her to fall. So in a sense, we're reaching out to her and we're saying, you know what? It's a terrible thing that you did, but confess your crime, because we will explain why it happened. Why did you lose control? You were under the influence. Number two, another reason that maybe brought you to the influence of the Yetzirah is harbe schok osa, that schok, when a person takes a laid back attitude towards life, eat, drink, and be merry, that's going to have an influence in which you lower your guard. As long as you have a serious, your head is twisted on tightly, in that attitude, you would not have done this affair, but maybe schok got the best of you. And even on Purim, like we said before, that we drink wine on Purim, even so, the poskim write, we shouldn't drink too much wine until the point that we get to, we lose it. And when we lose it, we don't think rationally. We don't make the right decisions. That's called schok. Chazal say over and over again that we have to do tshuva. Al-Khaitshekhatorul Fanecha Bischok Ubakalus Rosh. Kalus Rosh means when we're lightheaded. and we don't take life seriously, we don't realize that every moment presents a challenge to us, and that's called tzchok. Now, as I said before about yayin, that there are two sides to yayin. Yayin can be used for holiness. So too, tzchok can be used for holiness. The Gemara tells us in the Sefer Brachos that Rebbe, before he started a shir, would introduce tzchok. Now, in the middle of shir, he wouldn't do such a thing, because once you get down to the shir itself, you got to be focused. You know, you can't be distracted. Distracted. Thank you so much. But once, before we start the shir, you know, we crack a joke or two and we get into the mood. The only problem is, if you're a Magid Shir, after a time period, it gets very challenging. You run out of jokes. So they say, Rabbi, you told us that joke already. Come up with new jokes. But we want to put a person into a good mood. And the contrast between a schok, which is antithetical, and a schok, which is holy, is the contrast between Avram and Sarah. You may remember that the three angels came to notify Sarah that she's going to have a child. There's no way, no how, that Sarah's going to have a child. That's impossible. She's past the age of 90. She doesn't have Orach Kanoshim. According to Rabbeinu Bechai, she didn't even have a womb. You know, she had like a hysterectomy kind of situation. There was no way, al pi derech hateva, according to nature, that she could mother a child. So it says, Vatischak Sarah bekirba, the same exact word, schok. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avram, this is not right. Am I incapable of changing nature? Well, why is she making a laughter about this? Why is she taking it serious? So Chazal say that tzchok is the tzchok of Mishle. If you've ever read the book of Mishle, the word tzchok in Mishle appears on every page. Mm-hmm. And it's called the tzchok of a ksil. Now, it's very difficult for me to translate the word ksil. Some people translate it as an idiot. That's not what it means. Ksil is not an intellectual category. Ksil is a person whose attitude towards life is a laid-back attitude. It's a cynical attitude. I would say a ksil is a cynic. He looks at life and he analyzes human experience from a perspective of physicality. And he realizes that we're here for a limited amount of time, 70 years, 80 years, maybe more, and that's it. So in that perspective, if life is nothing more than physicality, and we're here today and we're finite and we're going to go on tomorrow, we might as well take advantage of every possible pleasure. So that's the kind of attitude of schok of a ksil. And unfortunately, Sarah had fallen into this trap. She had this cynical attitude. She looked at herself, her physical being, and she realized the physicality prevented her from having a child, so she laughed. Ha ha ha. That's what we call lag, if you've ever heard that word. Lag is when you laugh and you make fun of somebody. But Avram Avinu, and all the Mefarshim ask this, at the end of Parshas Lech Lecha, also says, Vayishak Avram. He also laughed. In fact, the Pasuk says that because he laughed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that the name of the child that's going to be born is Yitzchak. So what's going on over here? When Sarah laughs, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets angry. Gives her a whole musa shmuz. When Avram laughs, no comment, no criticism. Adarabba. You know, Avram Avinu says, because of your schok, we're going to name Yitzchak, one of the forefathers of Klal Yisrael, with the name Yitzchak. So Chazal say that the schok of Yitzchak was the schok of Kedusha. That laughter could be an expression of joy. Avram Avinu was nispoil. He was absolutely amazed. How could it be? I'm already 100 years old and I'm going to father a child. My wife is 90 and she's, you know, incapable of having children. This is unbelievable. This means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the master of the universe. He can control and change the nature, the natural law. That was Avram Avinu's schok. That's schok of Kedusha. And then we get to the third category that puts a certain spin and explains, so to speak, why she fell prey and she committed this crime. Harbe yaldus osa. Yaldus means immaturity. Very often a person forgets what his age is. He acts in a way of a child. A child doesn't really consider what's going to happen down the line. A child lives in the very moment of the present. It's very interesting. The Mishnah says in Masechta Ksuvos that two witnesses who signed on a shtar under certain circumstances are believed to disqualify the shtar. How can they disqualify the shtar? The Mishnah gives a few examples, one of which is ketanim hayinu. It means that when we signed the shtar, we were children. And although it could be that the eidus, the testimony in that document is true, but nevertheless, the shtar, the document is disqualified because we signed it before we were bar mitzvah. Now, bar mitzvah doesn't have to do with intellectual maturity. The Vilna Gaon, for example, according to tradition, I can't verify this, knew Shas at the age of 6. The Machmirim say at the age of 8. He was a genius, the likes of which we haven't seen. You probably could have made 2 Einsteins out of the Vilna Gaon. But nevertheless, he's a katan. Halachically, he's not a gadol. Intellectually, he's way beyond his years. And I've known many children, and you know of many children, who are precocious beyond their years. But childhood and yaldus is a question of what we call moral and ethical maturity. When a person acts like a child, and we often do that, we take risks, we enjoy the moment, we're very concerned with how we are evaluated by other people. A child is very sensitive. You know, what are they going to think? That's why children come home from Gan, how do you say it in English? Gan, from the kindergartens, and we find out from their children, from their teachers, that they did things in order to find favor in the eyes of others. This woman acted as a child. She was caught in a relationship with another man. He cajoled her. He wooed her, he enticed her, and she, like a child, wanted to give this man pleasure, wanted to make him happy. She was worried about his view of her, how he would evaluate her, so she participated. She was a child, and she didn't think of the repercussions down the line. What would it do to our reputation? Children take risks with their reputation. There's a famous story about, I can't remember his name right now, he was a judge, and there was a convention of the National Convention of the Democratic Party, and his name came up as a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. And everyone was impressed, and you know, the things were really moving towards his getting the nomination. But what happened is, one man stood up, and he said, "I went to college with this fellow, and in college, this is the way he acted. I'm not going to go into detail." And as a result, the man was disqualified to get the greatest, what would at that time, I don't know today, was considered the greatest treasure anyone could want on the face of the earth, the presidency of the United States. People act like children. They don't realize that they are soiling and endangering their reputation. And finally, and this I think is the most powerful influence, Harbe Shechenim Roim Osim. We are a product of our society. If we live in the wrong neighborhood, if we have bad neighbors, we are influenced and impacted. You know that the word for morality is ethics. Does anybody know what language that word comes from? I'm just curious if you happen to know. The word ethics, it's not an English word.
From Greek.
From Greek, exactly. And ethics in Greek, ethos, means ethos. Culture, mores, whatever the society believes. And the Rambam writes extensively about finding the right atmosphere. He says that Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, Kodesh Baruch Hu told Avram, get the heck out of there, because you don't realize the influence of society upon your life. We want to live the way our society says we should live. And very often, if we live in a society which accepts immoral behavior, it becomes for us moral behavior. Everybody's doing it. Keep up with the Joneses. So all this is to influence her, as if to say, your crime is horrible, but confess your crime. You fell prey. You're still a human being. We can live with this confession. I have in front of me the art scroll. I'm wondering if anything that I said appears in art scroll. Just one second. Well, I don't see it often. But I think that's pshat in the Mishnah, so we'll have to send a letter to art scroll. And anybody see anything here? No, I don't see anything. Anyway.
What happens if she admits it?
She gets a get, and that's it. The whole story ends right there.
And what about her onesh? Does she go before the
Sanhedrin? No, there's no punishment. No punishment, because the Torah doesn't have self-incrimination. Here is one of the most fundamental differences between Jewish law. You know, I was originally, Rabbi Mize asked me to teach Jewish law at this hour, but he changed it to Sota. But here's the overlap. What's fundamental about Jewish law, as opposed to secular law, is self-incrimination. There's no such thing as self-incrimination in Jewish law. It's amazing. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin that if a person testifies against someone else that he extended a loan and took interest on the loan, he's believed. We need another witness, but he's believed together with another witness. Even, listen to this, if he says, I was the one who took the loan. In other words, we ask him, oh, you're saying about Reuven that he extended a loan with interest, and he received interest with great repercussions in Allah. So we ask him, and who borrowed the money? I did. If you borrow money with interest, you violate a law of d'oraisa. The Torah prohibits interest for both the malva and the lova, the lender and the borrower. The borrower is...
You're an accomplice.
Well, it's more than that. It's that you paid interest. The Torah says you're not allowed to transfer interest from one end to the other.
Exactly.
You can call it an accomplice if you like, if that helps you, but me, it doesn't help.
No, but if there's a difference, because the accomplice is someone who is a willing accomplice. There are people, for example, who are accomplices unwillingly.
Correct, but again, that has to do with a principle called onus rachmana patra, meaning the Torah alleviates a person if he's compelled to do something.
Right.
I wasn't getting into that. I was just saying that the Torah prohibits any passing of money in a loan, right, whether it's passing in this direction in taking, or it's passing in this direction in receiving.
Beautiful.
And now the Gemara says that we believe this witness. How can we believe this witness when he himself, by his own admission, has incriminated himself? And the Gemara says we don't even hear those words. They don't even register on the radar screen. What do you mean you took the loan? You paid ribs. We can't accept that. And you know, if you study Western law, you'll know that the biggest evil, perhaps, maybe I'm dramatizing it, in Western law, is what they call plea bargaining. Plea bargaining is based on self-incrimination. The halacha doesn't have a problem with plea bargaining. The most fundamental issue in law today in Western society is not even relevant to halacha, because it's all based on self-incrimination. We're going to try to cajole you to confess your crime. We're going to offer you a leniency in terms of, instead of sitting in the clink for 30 years, we'll let you out after 10 years. If you just give us that confession. Confession is meaningless in halacha. How do we get into this? I don't know. You asked me a question.
I'm sorry.
No, what was...
What? If she admits it.
Oh, it has no repercussions whatsoever. Just that he has to divorce her because of Kini and Stira. That has nothing to do with the adultery per se. I mean, it has a lot to do with the adultery. But after Kini and Stira, I mentioned this to you over and over again. The issues, the relationship between the husband and wife is impaired. It's no longer complete. It could be that there would be no yibum. I mean, there are many dinim. But basically, that's why I told you that in our day, the worst thing you want to do is give your wife a kinu, because if you give her a kinu and she violates the kinu, that's the end of the marriage. We don't have Bei Marorim today. We don't have the Beis Hamikdash. There's no Sanhedrin HaGedolah. So after kinu and stira, he has to divorce his wife. But that's the only repercussion here.
Except Mishama, Mina Shemayim.
That's up to Hashem. Yeah. You know, Hashem maybe would now again, you know, I'm not sure if you and I would want to marry this woman. You know, there are other women in the market that I think would be more attractive than this woman.
Is she allowed to remarry?
Yeah, sure. Anybody can marry her. Again, I wouldn't recommend it. You know, if you ask me, if I was your rabbi, I would say to you, find a different woman. You know, this woman is by her own admission. But as far as the halacha is concerned, anybody could marry her. What else are we going to tell him?
And then we have a prophet who accepted his wife. You even after she had a relationship.
Oh, this I don't know. You can't ask me about
that. Very, very flexible.
You can't ask me about that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on. Asi lishmo agadol. Again, we're trying to influence her. We try to win her over. We say, look, realize what's happening here. If you are indeed guilty, confess your guilt. Nothing terrible is going to happen because we don't accept self-incrimination. But you know what? Do it for the sake of Shmo HaGadol. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to get into this discussion here about what exactly is Shmo HaGadol. But there's a name of God which has 42 letters. Have you heard of it?
Tetragrammaton.
Maybe it's called Tetragrammaton. I'm not sure. I don't know enough about that. But that's called the Shem Ben Membes Osios. And it's really interesting because when, as I mentioned to you earlier, Moshe Rabbeinu asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what's your name? Mashmi Ma'omer Lehem. So Hashem answers, Eyasher Eyeh. And there are many, many statements in Chazal why he has to double the word Eyeh. So if you know a little bit about Gematria, I'll tell you a secret. Eyeh, and again, it's not high in mathematics, because Eyeh has two Hays and a Yud and an Aleph. How much is that? 21, right?
21, yeah.
Now, if you multiply 21 by 2, because it's Eyeh, Eyeh, twice, so you get 42. And it's interesting that this is the name of God which Moshe Rabbeinu was told to transmit to the people. And it may have been the holy name of 42 letters. And the Gemara Kiddushin goes through a whole discussion about who's a candidate to receive the tradition as to what those 42 letters are. I don't know if anybody here in this room is a candidate.
In no shape.
I don't want to insult anybody, but I'm including myself. I mean, the list of candidate of requirements, of, you know, the CV for getting the name of 40. Now, I don't know if anyone today has the you know, maybe the Kabbalists. You have to ask the Bali Kabbalah if they have it. You have a connection to the Frenchies? Right, your wife speaks French, right? So see if she knows any Kabbalists. You know, let's find out if who knows the 42 letters of God's holy name. You could, by the way, you could do it on Google, and they'll tell you something. But I wouldn't rely on Google. Okay, but in any event, this is the holy name of God. Right, shenichta b'kedusha. Right, it has to be written with holiness. And shalo yimoch al amayim, and we're going to erase it on the waters. In other words, part of the process of getting this, the ritual of getting this bit of waters, is that we take the Shem Hashem, we inscribe it on a cloth, and we mush it up together with the mechatos, and we burn, and we basically have a drink, this crazy, you know, concoction, which is very dangerous, but it requires the blotting out of the name of God, the holy name of God. And that's explicit in Parshas Noso, in the Parshas Bamidbar of the Sota.
Very interesting correlation, Rabbi.
Yeah.
Of when Moshe Rabbeinu says, when he says he's going to blot out the Jewish people, he says, no, blot me out, Moshe Rabbeinu says. And the whole idea of what Hillel Hashem here, of that, and yet how God tries so desperately for Shalom Bayis. Over and above everything,
right?
Even
excellent.
Even with the laugh with the lie, the sheker that took place between Abraham and Sarah, that they should not have a quarrel amongst themselves, or even think for a moment less than of each other.
Are you a rabbi?
No, I'm a judge.
A judge. Okay. So you sound like you're a Darshan. You know that you transmit
I
Torah.
Study as much as I can.
No, not study, but it sounds like you have that ability to transmit.
I also write a sonnet on each pesachta.
The Morale of Prague.
Okay. So what do you learn in Daf Yomi?
Daf Yomi, I just finished, and I read a sonnet also that's published by Chabad on
Wow. Okay.
The Morale of Prague.
Excellent. So I see you very advanced. Wow. How many times did you go through Shas so far?
At different times, because I studied also in Drops University, you might have heard of.
In Philadelphia.
With Solomon Zaksa.
Yeah, my brother, love may rest in peace, has his PhD.
I was doing my doctorate work there. One time.
Did you by any chance know my brother Eli Greenwald? No? I have a beautiful picture.
What year was that?
When did he get his PhD? I would say, I'm just guessing, about maybe 45, 50 years ago. I'm trying to just put it.
I was there between 1974 and 1976.
No, he's way before then.
Yeah. Right.
Anyway.
Rabbi, I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying you. I mean, all the examples that you're giving us, that's it. Mahaya, we're so, I mean, so grateful. When I see someone like you who's become like that, it's fantastic. I'm
oh, thank
very
you.
Grateful.
Thanks so much. Okay. You know, flattery will get you everywhere.
Came by accident and did fall.
There are very few people who come into here my class and give me a compliment. I don't know, the ELC seems to be such a cold place.
God bless you. You should go from strength to strength.
All right, thank you. Okay, let's go on. And now there's another psychological trick here, a different approach. You know, if the first method didn't succeed, we have two methods so far. First of all, to justify, so to speak, in inverted commas, what she did, why did she do it, what were the influences. Secondly, to impress upon her that she could save this terrible Chil Hashem, as you say, of blotting out the name of God. Here's the third approach. And that is, he v'chol mishpachas beis aviha. What's at stake here is not just her own reputation, because she's going to cause the blotting of God's name and maybe she'll be destroyed if she's guilty, but it also has an impact on the reputation of her father's family. Now, this is really interesting to me, personally, why it mentions the father, Beis Aviha. I would have mentioned either Beis Horeha, or Beis Imeha. You know, a woman is usually closer to her mother than to her father. But yet, when it comes to family reputations, the halacha and the Torah itself puts all the emphasis on Beis Avir. For example, when the Torah says in the parish of Matos about Nedarim, a woman took a neder, if she was a Nara, which means she was between the ages of 12 and 12 and a half, it says, Binureha Beis Avia. The same two words that appear here in the Mishnah, you'll see in Parshas Matos. Or, for example, at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, when we take a census of Klal Yisrael, it says, L'mishpachosam L'beis Avosam. We always go to the father. And even when we take out a woman to be killed because she had an immoral relationship, even in that context, the Torah says that she has defiled the reputation of her father. And that's the case of a Bas Kohen. And there's a particular defilement of the Kiddush of Kuna in the case of a Bas Kohen who had this kind of relationship. In any event, if you confess your crime, you're saving the future reputation of Beis Aviha. Nobody has to know whether you're guilty or not. We're not going to accept your self-incrimination, as we said over and over again. But nevertheless, we're going to terminate this whole process instead of making a public demonstration of blotting out the name of God, having you drink it, and all the repercussions thereof. Im amra tmeah ani, if she admits her crime, Shoveres ksubasa v'yotzeis. Basically, I would take out a seven-piece band. We're in a state of absolute pleasure and joy over here because she admits her crime and the whole process now ends and we don't have to go through it and we don't have to blot out the name of God. We don't have to bring about her death. But what does the word shoveres mean? And if you have an art scroll, I would ask you not to look in art scroll.
To break, actually.
Shoveres ksubasa, she breaks her ksuba. But that's not true. It's not that she breaks her ksuba, but that she gives a shovar for the ksuba. This word shovar in halacha is what we call not an IOU note, but a receipt, a bill of receipt. What that means is the following. If you have a shtar as a malva, which means that I owe you money, you use that shtar and produce it in a court of law to prove with evidence beyond question that I owe you the money. Unless I can produce what's called a shovar. And the shovar says that even though I didn't take the shtar back from you, but I did pay you up, and when I gave you the money that I owed you and I repaid the loan, I needed testimony from you to attest to the fact that I paid you, because otherwise, maybe you'll find the shtar, and you'll produce the shtar, and you'll collect a second time around, and Beis Din will actually rely on that shtar, not knowing that they had already collected, and she had already paid up the shtar. In the case of a ksuba, the ksuba remains in the hands of a woman. If it remains in the hands of a woman, then he, the husband, is vulnerable to possibly producing the ksuba at a later time, in a different Beis Din, and claiming that she never got paid the ksuba. And that Beis Din is unaware. You know, it's not like today we have Facebook and we have all sorts of modes of communication. Back in the day, what could happen to one Beis Din is unknown to another Beis Din, and vice versa. So she shows up in another Beis Din, she produces a ksuba. That Beis Din has no knowledge of the fact that that ksuba is completely disqualified. She was a sota, and he doesn't have to pay the ksuba. So in order to guarantee that he is protected against the possibility that she not only cheated against him in an immoral relationship, but she'll cheat against him to get collect the ksuba when she has no rights to the ksuba, she has to sign a document called a shovar. And the shovar is now given from her to him. And in the shovar it states that she has no rights to the ksuba. And that's going to protect him financially against the possibility that she'll show up in a different Beis Din. Now why does she lose her ksuba? We haven't even proven that she's guilty. She admitted that she's guilty. Well, we don't rely on her confession. That's called self-incrimination. Ein ode meisim atzma rasha. We don't rely on a person. What's the answer, David?
I don't know.
You do know. That's why I called him, because I know you know. Because of kinyan and stira. The very moment that she had kinyan and stira, which means she willingly went into a private place with this person, she loses her rights to the ksuba. Now the exception to that rule is if she undergoes the process of mei merorim and she survives it. In that case, we prove that she was innocent. But if we cannot undergo that whole process, if she cannot undergo that process, then as a result, we go back to Kinyan Stira. And he's not allowed to live with her. But again, there may be situations where he can't live with her that have no, you know, that are not, that she's not liable or culpable. She wasn't guilty for that. I mean, there are situations, for example, where she cannot bear children, so he may have to divorce her, but she'll collect her ksuba. She's not in any way guilty for having broken up the marriage, but in this case that she went into stira with a private place, she forfeits her rights to ksuba. After all this effort, lo ola biyadeinu, we weren't successful. Omra taharani, she still insists I am guiltless. She knows that she's guiltless. Or at least we think she's guiltless because she has the chutzpah to place herself into this tremendous danger. So now we go back to the original discussion that we started with, the subject of this Mishnah, meaning the procedure. So what is the procedure at this point? Mailin osol shahar hamizrach. They take her up to the eastern wall of the Beis HaMikdash. And do they enter into the Beis HaMikdash?
No.
The Mishnah says there's something called Shar Nikanor. Now, Shar Nikanor has both historical background and halachic status. Shal Pesach Shar Nikanor, we put her at the entrance into the Shar Nikanor, and there she's going to have to drink from the bitter waters. What is the history of Shar Nikanor, and what is the halachic status of Shar Nikanor? The history is described by the Gemara in Masechta Midos. There was an individual by the name of Nikanor. When they wanted to get contributions to set up the gates, he brought his contribution. He was on his way from Alexandria to the Beis HaMikdash, and there was a terrible flood. Not a flood, a shipwreck. As a result, the ship was going to sink. Everyone had to jump out of the ship to save themselves. But Nicanor could not part with what he thought was his lifelong achievement to give this gift and contribute these beautiful doors to the Beis HaMikdash. And Chazal and the Gemara Yuma describe how he jumps into the water, holding on to the two gates. And one of the gates would go down to the bottom. The other gate miraculously would carry him all the way to the Beis HaMikdash. And the reason why he got this supernatural miracle is because he loved the Beis HaMikdash. And that sincere love brought him to even endanger himself by holding on to these gates and making this contribution. That's the history of Shar Nikanor. But what is the halachic status of Shar Nikanor? Very often the halacha looks at a door and defines it as bifnim. It's considered part of the room. Often the halacha says that the door is outside of the room. And the technical word for this in halacha is called iskupa. Iskupa is like the threshold. And if you, for example, if you learn the Gemara in Shabbos, there's something called Melechas Hotzah, which means I'm not allowed to bring something outside from a public area inside to a private area. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
So what happens if he walks from a private, from a public area into the Iskupa? He never actually entered into the room. And the halacha has to vacillate and analyze, is the Iskupa considered inside the house or outside the house? What's the status of the Shaar Nikanor? We do not want to be mashke sota inside the Beis HaMikdash. The sanctity of the Beis HaMikdash is so intense that it rejects this process in which, as we'll soon see, we expose her or parts, certain parts of her body. Again, Rabbi Yehuda's going to object. He's a dissenting view, but according to the Chachamim, we have to do this. The Torah requires of it. And then we're going to have a drink. And then she's going to blow up if she's guilty. We don't want this to happen within the confines of the Beis HaMikdash. But on the other hand, the Torah itself says that we have to bring her up to the Beis HaMikdash. So what do? Where is this pshara, this compromise, where she's in the Mikdash, but she's not really in the Mikdash? And the answer is that there are two kedushos, there are two different sanctities to the Beis HaMikdash. There's a sanctity of the Beis HaMikdash which is called Kiddushas Makom. Makom means a location. And there's a sanctity which is called Kiddushas Mechitzos. So you're familiar with this? Mechitzos means the walls themselves. So that an area which was designated for the Beis HaMikdash has Kiddusha. For example, David HaMelech, even before Shlomo built the Mikdash, had already designated an area with Kiddushas Mikdash. And this is an area that he bought from Arnona, from a Yavusi, one of the members of the seven nations that occupied the land. Again, exactly how he left this Yavusi alive, that's a different discussion, because we have a mitzvah lo sechai called Neshama already at the time of Yeshua. So why was David HaMelech involved in this merchandise, this, what do you call it, a barter deal in buying the Goren Arnuna, what's called in Tanakh, for the Beis HaMikdash. But anyway, that's Kedushas Makom. The other Kedusha, which was an upgrade to a higher level of Kedusha, was initiated by whom? Not by David, but by Shlomo HaMelech. And that's called Kedushas Mechitzos. The status of Shaar Nikanor is Kedushas Makom without Kedushas Mechitzos. It has one dimension of Mikdash, but it's lacking the second dimension of Mikdash. On the one hand, it has Makom. It is a place that was designated for the Mikdash. It's the door to the Mikdash. But on the other hand, it's not within the Mechitzos. And therefore, it doesn't have that upgraded level of Kedusha. So the Mishnah says that that's a perfect place for being mashke sasota. Why? Because we don't want to enter into the full-fledged Kedushas Mikdash. What else takes place at that Shaar Nikanor? This already is a digression, and the Mishnah digresses to tell you about the status and the mitzvos that we fulfill in the Shaar Nikanor. Number one, there's what's called a Tumas Yoledes. A woman after she gives birth, again depending upon how many days go by, if she had a male child or a female child, this is all in Parsha Shmini, then she has to bring a karban. That's called a karban hayoledes. If we had about 6 months, we could discuss karban yoledes. It's one of the most profound sugyas in Shas. It's a very complicated karban made up of many different parts. But on the one hand, the yoledes right now is in a state of tumah. She has to bring a karban. We don't want to invite her into the mikdash, but yet she's got to bring the karban. She has to pass on the karban to the kohen and say, "This is my karban yoledes." And therefore, we set her up in a place that doesn't have kedushas mechitzos, and that's called the Shaar Nikanor. And finally, mitaren es hamitzora. The mitzora is a person who. What's the word I'm looking for? Who? No, I know what I mean. But what's the word? He has a manifestation of leprosy. What's the word I'm looking for? He contracts leprosy. I'm looking for a word which I'm not finding. David, you're always good for me for this. What word am I looking for? He
contracts.
He contracts tzaraas. By the way, is not leprosy. I hate to disappoint you. Spiritual. Again, I don't know what art school says.
Spiritual.
It just says tzaraas.
Okay, good. So he did a good job. He did not say leprosy, because leprosy is what we call a pathological, dermatological phenomenon that can be seen in a microscope and can be tested in a lab. and that's leprosy. I don't think that mitzaras is leprosy. I don't think it's physical. If it was physical, then it would apply even in Chutz Laaretz, it would apply even in Bisman HaZeh. No. Tzaras is something metaphysical. Anyway, a tzaras, a mitzora, has to bring a karbon when he completes his process of tara. So there are many different stages and requirements in this long process of purifying a mitzora. The culmination is when he brings a karbon. And by the way, if he doesn't bring a karbon, then he's what's called a mechusar kapara. And I mentioned this in case any of you are learning Daf Yomi. I don't know, you said you were learning Daf Yomi, yes, if it's anyone else.
Yes.
So the whole mission at the beginning of Masechta Brachas is all about a Mechusar Kapara. Mm-hmm. It's all about a person who contracted Tumah. He went to the mikvah, and the amount of time that he needs for purification has passed, but he hasn't yet brought his karbon. Because the karbon can only be brought the next day, on the eighth day. So he went through the 7 days, he jumps into the mikvah, but we have to wait till the eighth day. So the Mishnah actually is talking about the Zman for Kriyas Rashal Arvis, and it says, Mishash HaKonim Nichnasim Lechel B'Trumasam, from the time that a Kohen is allowed to eat Truma. Now that Kohen cannot bring a Karbon to the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because he's a Mechusa Kapari, he's a Zav or a Mitzora. So we have to wait until tomorrow, which would be the eighth day, until he's allowed to eat Kodshim. But the Mishnah says he's allowed to eat Truma. That's because Truma has what's called Kedushas Gvulin, whereas the Karbon has Kedushas Mizbeach. And in order to purify a Mitzora for Kedushas Mizbeach, he needs to reach the entire level, the complete Gemar Tara, the complete total purification, which only takes place in the morning when he brings his Karbon. But as far as Truma is concerned, which is only Kedushas Gvulin, in other words, Truma doesn't go on the Mizbeach, Truma is not brought into the Beis HaMikdash, Truma can be eaten anywhere. As far as that Kedusha is concerned, all he needs is what's called Herev Shemesh. All he needs is sunset. Alright, we're going to have to end. I'll just read the end of the Mishnah with you, so at least I can tell Rabbi Mois we learned the Mishnah. And we're back to the procedure. Kohen Ochez Bibagadeha. This is the Shita of the Tanakhama. We'll see that Rabbi Yehuda is not necessarily on board with this. The Kohen actually has to rip her clothes. Well, he may be ripping her clothes. He grabs onto her clothes. This is all to humiliate her, and hopefully she'll decide, I'm out of here. I'm going to confess my crime. Im nikru nikru, if he tears them, or im nifrumu nifrumu, or he really tears them in a more profound way, then nikru, that's what happened. In other words, you know, we have no claim or argument against the Kohen. The Kohen has to do what he has to do, and the repercussions are such. Not only that, the Torah says that Anshi Megalas Liba, he has to uncover the top part of her chest, and Soser Sarah, if she has braided hair, he has to take apart the braids. All this, by the way, has philosophical, deeper meanings, which are way beyond the purview of our discussion. But Rabbi Yehuda is not happy.
Doesn't he become Tomei?
No.
Isn't she?
There's no
potential. She might be a Nida, and he's touching a woman.
Oh, so I don't think Tumas Nida is contracted through Nagia. I think you need Mishkav and Moshe for that, if I remember correctly.
Huh?
I mean, again, I'm not learning Tumah Vitara here, but you'll check it out.
You can't sit on the same.
Yeah, that has to do with sitting. It has to do with sitting or lying on a bed. Okay, now. Im haya liba noa. Now, as we have every reason to believe that, you know, this is a public spectacle and people are watching this, and you know she's a female, and a female has a certain attraction, especially the top part of her chest. And for example, you expose her hair, and you know Chazal see this today. I don't know. It's a little sociologically. I think it's a little bit low profile. But back in the day of Chazal, and certainly in the day of the Mishnah, hair was considered very attractive. And now you can expose our hair. So all this is happening publicly. So the women are who are in the audience, that's not such a problem, but there are men in the audience. So Rabbi Yehuda says, we're not going to do this. And he says, we didn't do this. And even though the Torah requires that we do it, but the Chachamim are going to make a separate takana. And this is called Yesh Koach. This is a sugya in Yevamos called Yesh Koach Biad Chachamim Lakar Dov Min HaTorah B'Shevi Altas. Are you familiar with that? Like, for example, if Shabbos coincides with Rosh Hashanah, do we blow the shofar?
No.
No, we don't blow the shofar. The Torah says we have to blow the shofar. But the Chachamim made a takana that we don't blow the shofar. You know, how did the Chachamim have the authority to do so? So under certain very limited circumstances, with restrictions and regulations, the Chachamim are granted authority to undermine a Torah law. But they can only do that b'shevi altas. They can do it in a passive way. We won't take the shofar. We're not going to violate the Torah, but we won't fulfill the Torah's The Torah enjoins us to blow the shofar. We won't do so. Here too, the Torah joins us to be Megala Liba and Sarah, but we're not going to do this, Rabbi Yehuda, for the benefit of the greater good here, because if people see what's going on here, you know, they're spectators, it's not a spiritually healthy thing. Okay, I see that we're not going to be able to finish the Mishnah, so please don't report me to the authorities. They'll dock me from my great salary. I'm just joking. So everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos. And hopefully we'll never have to see the...
You give a class every Thursday here?
I don't know exactly what Rabbi Myers has in mind, but so far he told me that I'm on board on Thursday to fill in for him at 9:30 on Thursday morning.
Every week this week? This coming month?
Again, I you know, whatever Rabbi Myers tells me.
Will he be doing something?
Yeah, I think so. Unless he gives me back to Jewish law.
As is there a possibility that he would give Daf Yomi?
Yeah, I'd love to give Daf Yomi.
I'm here.
I'm here too.
I'm there. Wherever...
Yeah.